Good evening. It's time for another bedtime story with Thompson. We are reading from The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. This is chapter 16. What's that say?
Escape.
It wasn't until the next day, the 11th day, that I felt safe enough to venture out from the coal cellar. I checked the pantry, but it was empty. Every scrap of food was gone. Apparently the Martian had taken it all on the previous day. At this discovery, I began to lose hope for the first time. So on the 11th and 12th days, I had no food or water. At first, my mouth and throat were parched, and my strength slowly began to leave me. I sat in the darkness of the scullery, wretched and despondent, thinking only of eating. By the end of the 12th day, my throat was so painful that I decided to risk alerting the Martians just so I could use the creaking water pump at the kitchen sink. The couple of glassfuls of blackened rainwater greatly refreshed me, and the fact that no prying tentacle followed the noise of my pumping greatly relieved me. All during the 13th and 14th days I dozed, but my sleep was filled with horrible dreams, sometimes of the curate's death, sometimes of sumptuous dinners. Early on the 15th day, I heard the curious, familiar sound of a dog's scratching coming from the kitchen. Creeping out of the coal cellar, I saw a dog's nose sniffing in at the peephole. Smelling me, he began to bark.
"Here, boy,"
I whispered, hoping to lure him inside where he wouldn't attract the attention of the Martians.
"Good dog."
But he suddenly withdrew his head and disappeared. I listened for several minutes, but the pit was still. Finally, I dared a look. In one corner of the pit, a group of black crows were fighting over the skeletons of the dead bodies the Martians had eaten. But there was not another living thing in the pit. I stared hard, scarcely believing my eyes. All the machinery was gone, and only the empty circular pit remained. Slowly I pushed myself out through the peephole and stood upon the mound of rubble. Not a sign of Martians was to be seen. My chance of escape had come. Trembling violently, I scrambled to the top of the house in which I had been buried for so long. I looked around again, north, south, east, west. Not a Martian was visible. When I had last seen this part of the village of Mortlake, it had been a street of comfortable white houses surrounded by rich, shady trees. Now, as I stood on a mound of ruined bricks and gravel, all I saw were burned, dead trees and wrecked houses. But a gentle breeze blew, and I took long, hard tastes of that rich, sweet air. Once my lungs tasted the air, my stomach reminded me of my long and dismal fast. I looked around for some place to obtain food. Beyond a low wall, I saw a garden patch, and I hurried towards it. Here I found some young onions and carrots and a few gladiolus bulbs. I gobbled them up, then climbed back over the wall and made my way towards the next village. Farther along the way, I happened upon a group of mushrooms, which I devoured, then I drank from the brown flowing water of a shallow stream. I rested for the remainder of the daylight in some thick shrubbery. My weakened condition would not permit me to push on. After sunset, I struggled on along the road towards the village of Putney. From a hill outside the village, I looked down on blackened trees, blackened, desolate ruins, and silence. The heat ray had passed here. As I gazed down at the silent desolation, I felt that mankind had been swept out of existence, that I was the last man left alive, and that the Martians had gone on to seek food elsewhere. Perhaps, even now, they were destroying Berlin, or Paris, or were heading for America. I found a deserted inn on top of Putney Hill. I broke into it and ransacked every room for food. I turned up a crust of bread, already gnawed on by rats, two cans of pineapple, and several hard biscuits. Before going to bed, my first real bed since I left my home at Mayberry, I prowled from window to window, peering out for some sign of the monsters. As I lay in bed, reinforced by some of the food I had found, I turned my thoughts to the problem of the Martians and the fate of my wife. I had no information on either, but I could imagine 100 things. As I started doing this, the night became terrible. I found myself sitting up in bed, staring at the dark, and praying that if my wife had died in this war, that her death would have been painless with a blast of the heat ray, rather than have her fall victim to the Martians' search for human blood. The morning was bright and fine as I crept out of the inn and started down the road. My plan was to go on to Leatherhead, though I knew I had very little chance of finding my wife there. If she wasn't dead, then surely she and her cousins would have fled. Perhaps I could learn where. My heart ached to find her. I had stopped to look at a swarm of little frogs frolicking in a swamp in the morning sunshine when suddenly I had the odd feeling of being watched. I spun around and saw something crouching in a clump of bushes. As I walked slowly towards it, it rose and became a man armed with a cutlass. He stood silent and motionless, staring at me. He was dressed in clothes as dusty and filthy as my own. His black hair fell over his eyes, and his face was dark and dirty and sunken, with a large red cut across his chin.
"Stop!"
he cried hoarsely when I was a few feet from him. "Where do you come from?"
"I come from Mabry Hill," I said. "I was on my way to Leatherhead when I was buried near a pit the Martians had made around one of their cylinders, but I worked my way out."
"Well, you can't stay here," he said. "This is my country. There is only food for one."
"I don't wish to stay here," I answered slowly. "I have been buried in the ruins of a house for 13 or 14 days. I don't know what has happened. I only know I want to go to Leatherhead and search for my wife." The man looked at me doubtfully, then suddenly shot out a pointing finger.
"It is you," he cried. "The man who took me in and fed me. I thought you were killed at Weybridge."
I recognized him at the same moment.
"You are the artilleryman who came to my house."
"We are lucky ones," he said, shaking my hand. "After the Martians left the river, I escaped across the fields. That was 16 days ago, and, good Lord, man, your hair has turned gray. But we are out too much in the open. Let us crawl under those bushes and talk."
"Have you seen any Martians?" I asked,
once we were safely hidden.
"They've gone towards London," he replied. "At night the sky is lit up with them moving, and just last night they had something up in the air. I believe they've built a flying machine and are learning to fly."
"Fly!" I cried. "Then it is all over for us. If they can fly, they will simply go around the world and destroy all life."
He nodded and said sadly, "It is all over for us already. We're down. We're beat. They've lost one. Just one. But they've walked all over us and crippled the greatest power in the world."
I still held out a vague hope, but the artillerymen went on dashing that hope. "The death of that Martian in the river at Weybridge was an accident. Besides, these are only pioneers. They'll keep on coming. I've seen those green stars, and they're probably still falling somewhere every night." Suddenly I recalled the night at Ogilvy's observatory, and I explained to the artillerymen, "After the 10th shot, they fired no more."
"Probably just something wrong with their gun," he said. "They'll get it right again. Nothing will change the end. It's just like men and ants, and that's what we are now to the Martians. Just like ants, only we're eatable ants. First, they'll smash us up, our shops, our guns, our railways, our cities. Then they'll begin catching us as they want us, picking out the best and storing us in cages. Our cities, our nations, our civilization, our progress, it's all over. We're beat."
And that's the end of part 1. We're all out of time. We'll be back for part 2. Good night.